Welcome to Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? I'm Annie.
And I'm Dave. Each month we take it in turns to nominate a film, a TV show or book we were a fan of before we were married and the other one doesn't really know.
Then we both watch or read it and come together to discuss our reactions. Fair warning, there will be spoilers.
So this month, Annie's choice was the 2016 TV show Dickensian, which is a little bit of a cheat on the normal rules for the podcast.
It's our podcast. We can break the rules if we want to. But yes, this is came out, 7 years after we got married? So it technically is ineligible, but meh.
2016 is 10 years ago. We could do an entire podcast on how that's just impossible. But anyway, right. What did you think, having...
Aren't you supposed to ask why I picked it?
Yeah, I've gone wrong. Let's go back and do this again. It's a great start.
Just forge onwards.
No.
Really?
This month, Annie's choice was the 2016 TV show...
It's 2015, isn't it?
This month, Annie's choice was the 2015 TV show Dickensian. Why did you pick this particular show?
Because I gave you Bleak House... Must be Christmas before this one that was just gone, although it's not just gone because it's several months later. Anyway, yes, at some point in the not too dim and distant past, I gave you a copy of Bleak House because I thought you would like it, despite the fact that you said you didn't like Dickens. And then I was waiting for you to finish reading that so that Dickensian would make more sense. Because I knew there were Bleak House references, and that's why I picked it.
That was impressively rambly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it was really interesting reading Bleak House, partly because my, basically like everybody else, previous exposure to Dickens was at school, where I was forced to read Great Expectations and came away with the idea that I really...
I thought you read David Copperfield.
Or David Copperfield.
Okay.
No, it's David Copperfield, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
See, that's one of my favourite Dickens books.
And... It's one of the few that isn't actually referenced in Dickensian, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think it is. I think there's one character name drops Uriah Heep.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
But he's not actually in it.
So, where was I? Yes, so I came away from school with the idea that I hated Dickens as I'd been forced to read this thing. And then we went on a reading retreat a while back and somebody recommended to me Vanity Fair, which I was like, I'd never read... a book like this, and I really, really enjoyed it. And it turns out that I really like Victorian literature, much to my great surprise. And so when Annie gave me Bleak House, I thought, I haven't read any Dickens in 30 years, but I'll give it another go. And I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So
I remember being a good one.
Yeah.
Anyway, we haven't actually explained what Dickensian is.
No.
And my best way to describe it is that it's Dickens fan fiction.
Yes.
Because... And I use it as an example of really good fan fiction because the only thing that most people know when you say fan fiction is 50 Shades of Grey, which was originally Twilight fan fiction, and it makes me want to burn everything because there's an awful lot of really creative, really fantastically written fan fiction out there, and that's the thing that people know. But anyway, Dickensian is basically a mashup of lots of different Dickens books. So there's a London street and it has Scrooge and Marley's money lending shop. It has the old curiosity shop. It's got various residents like the Havishams and the Barbarys and all sorts of different people from different books, and they're all interacting. And it's mostly prequels to the actual stories, but not entirely. It's all mixed up.
Yeah, it varies. It's a prequel to both Bleak House and
Great Expectations,
but it's a sequel to The Old Curiosity Shop.
How can it be?
Because, well, spoilers.
Well, we do spoilers, but it can't be a sequel to the... It can't be after the events of The Old Curiosity Shop because Nell's still alive at the beginning.
Well, that's my point. One of my things in this is maybe he just changes what happens. But anyway. Are you going to ask me what I thought?
Yes, what were your thoughts overall? I got deep into what it was about and thus plot stuff.
I was going to talk about fan fiction, but
we're all over the place. We're
already so far off the script, yes.
There's 20 episodes and they're half an hour each, and we watched the first four. But mm-hmm. it is an entire plot. They're not individual episodes that stand alone. It follows on. So we've only seen a fifth of the story. I can do maths, me.
Mm-hmm.
So go on. What did you think?
So I have complicated feelings about this because I enjoyed it much more by episode four.
Mm.
And I would like to watch the rest of them.
Me too.
Because it felt like it was starting to come together. My big problem with this is that possibly more than any show I've seen for a really long time, it just dumps you in with a huge number of characters that you're supposed to keep track of from episode one that are apparently just all completely unconnected. They all just happen to be in the same area of London. And you're just absolutely overwhelmed and baffled and bamboozled with what is going on. And the reason why this happens is because the writer has this notion that people will know who these characters are. So he doesn't need to explain in a lot of cases what the backstories are and what the interconnectedness between a bunch of the characters are, because you're expected to know that when you land. And if you don't know that, if you came to this completely cold, I knew some of the characters and we might get into that, but if you came to this completely cold, I can't imagine that you would get to the end of episode one and think, I'd like to watch any more of that, because it's just
too much. Yeah.
Absolutely fair. Baffling.
I had forgotten that. Well, I because you've only in recent years read the one, Bleak House, mm-hmm. which I thought would be useful, and I'm expecting mm-hmm. that you'll know more about the Bleak House characters than I do.
Bleak House is complicated because you've got Inspector Bucket, who's one of the protagonists, and I really like, although we can probably talk again about how the characters as they're portrayed on screen are very different from how I imagine them in some cases.
Yes.
But it's again weird for Bleak House because Bucket is, well, it's a prequel, it's like he's only just starting out being a detective. And the two principal characters from Bleak House that are in Dickensian, by the time Bleak House itself starts, I think one of them is dead, and I think the other one is only very, very barely in it, because Bleak House is about the daughter of the one who dies. So this is a prequel. So the main two Bleak House characters, in inverted commas, that are in Dickensian, aren't really in Bleak House at all.
No, but you understand who they are better than I would. Yes. Uh-huh. But having said that, the main books that you need to have some information about are Oliver Twist, A Christmas Carol, and Great Expectations, and those are the ones that, even if people haven't actually read them, because I haven't read The Christmas Carol and I haven't read Great Expectations, but I'm aware of the characters and who they are and what they signify and brief and largely what happens to them.
I mean,
and that's mostly what you need.
I mean, I can make
to appreciate it.
I mean, we're as we said, all over the shop, but I could make an argument that even that's not necessarily how I'd look at it, because Fagin and Bill Sykes and Nancy are in it, but the plot of Oliver Twist is kind of irrelevant. No. It's just knowing those three characters.
Yes, you need to understand who they are and what role they play.
Yes, fair.
And where they are in society.
Oh, yes.
In order
yes.
to
okay.
understand. Great Expectations, we've got Miss Havisham as a young woman who's just inherited her father's fortune and her father's business. And so you need to kind of understand and be aware of where she is at the beginning of mm-hmm. Great Expectations to see the massive doom-laden foreboding that hangs over the entire series, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Havishams in this that throw me the most, because they don't feel connected to the rest of the plot. We should say, plot-wise, dear God, we'll get to facts at some point, but we should say, plot-wise, that the, what's the word I'm after, thing that occurs,
the inciting incident,
thank you, the inciting incident that from which all this occurs, is that Jacob Marley is murdered by somebody, and then Inspector Bucket, who is not at all how I imagined him in Bleak House, but I still really like the way he's played in Dickensian.
Me too.
Turns up to the investigation, and as Scrooge, and Scrooge is brilliantly played in this. And yes. I think he's great. Agreed. As Scrooge says, but basically it could have been anybody. Absolutely everybody. I hated him. Everybody hated him.
Yeah. So that's what kind of joins things together. As you said, the Havisham storyline and the Honoria and Francis Barbary, who the ones from Bleak House, the ones whose father
ruined. Yes, sorry, and because they're basically not in Bleak House, I don't really recognise the names, but yes.
Yes, so there's two sort of well-to-do families, although the Barbarys are facing financial ruin, but
that's a very Dickensian, or in fact very...
They're friends with the Havishams, and that plot is kind of separate, but it is the other main plot strand, is Miss Amelia Havisham's brother is annoyed because their father has only given him a very small amount of money from the estate, and he is trying to orchestrate a situation whereby he can get more.
Yeah.
And that's the other main plot thread. And the Inspector Bucket investigating Marley's death, as you say, doesn't really connect.
Well, this was
at all. Although the brother does go to Scrooge for money.
He does, yeah.
Their lawyer is connected because he also goes to Scrooge about money. So Scrooge is kind of the linchpin, and he's the one that's connected to pretty much everybody, I think.
Well, their lawyer,
despite the fact that he doesn't like talking to anybody.
Their lawyer is interesting because their lawyer is in partnership with Mr. Tulkinghorn, who's the lawyer from Bleak House, and who is the one that's killed in Bleak House, which is the two-thirds of the way through inciting incident, working out who killed him. And it's a shame that he's a character that's not in it, because I liked him in Bleak House. But
okay. The suggestion by Mr. Jaggers is that he's not very good at his job.
Shall we do some facts?
I don't really have any facts. I wrote down the quote on Wikipedia from the Guardian review, because the Guardian reviewer is clearly not familiar with fan fiction as a concept, because it said that the new thing, talking about the writers using Dickens characters and forming a different story, the new thing is never going to be as good as the thing they came from. And that's kind of... I mean, I would argue that sometimes fanfic is better than the original.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And the whole point of it is that you can do things that would never happen in the original. So whilst, sure, a half-hour television drama is not going to be the same as a Dickens novel, because they're very different media and they're very different style of writing, but that's not the point, and the Guardian reviewer doesn't know what they're talking about.
I find it amusing that you say they're very different, but Dickens was famously paid by the word, which is why everything is very long and flowery. And
this, so they were serialised.
And this is 20 episodes.
Very good point, actually.
Which is a lot.
Very good point.
So,
anyway, what have you got, facts-wise?
Well, I can't even get the year right, because I've written down 2016 from Wikipedia.
Well, I thought that it was 2015 on IMDb, but who knows?
I don't know. It was created by somebody called Tony Jordan, who is best known, depending on how you look at it. He's written an enormous amount of EastEnders. That's his background.
I don't think I've ever watched an episode of EastEnders.
I was absolutely addicted to EastEnders and watched every episode for about the first 18 months
when
it first came out in the 1980s,
who knows,
maybe, but then not since then. He created a thing called Hustle that was very popular.
Never heard.
But also what's very interesting for me is he also created Life on Mars, which is a fantastic show. John Sim, yes, highly recommended. It was written by him and lots of other people, most of whom are other writers on EastEnders. It was directed by a guy called Harry Bradbeer, who directed all of Fleabag, which won a ton of awards.
Oh, Fleabag's amazing.
Killing
I
Eve.
Don't think you'd like Fleabag.
No, I think I watched the first episode and didn't get into it at all.
Yeah. It's very, very good.
Killing Eve, which I think we also watched one episode of.
I don't think I've ever seen
bounced
it.
Off. Which also won a ton of awards. But then those are TV shows, and then films. He's best known for directing Enola Holmes, which is
oh yeah.
What's her name from Thing?
Billy Bobby Brown?
Millie Bobby Brown.
Millie Bobby Brown, yes.
From Stranger Things.
Thank you.
Yes.
We didn't actually talk about my thoughts overall.
Oh.
What are your thoughts overall?
It was a lot more doom-laden and less funny than I remembered.
Okay.
I think I thought it was funny, but it's not. Well, I mean, it's amusing in terms of the way it's constructed, and I think it's very clever, but it is desperately tragic and quite horrifying as well. Go back to your facts.
Yes. Is future editing you going to, like, reorder all of this to make it make sense?
No.
We've got a lot of relatively famous people knocking around playing...
Yeah, fantastic cast.
...in the cast. Peter Firth as Jacob Marley is great. We've got Joseph Quinn as Arthur Havisham, Sophie Rundle as Honoria. She's weird because, again, with it being a prequel, they keep calling her Honoria, which is very confusing because in Bleak House she's only ever really referred to as Lady Dedlock. And Lord Dedlock turns up in this. And I have a very particular picture of what Lord Dedlock looks like in my head, which is...
Who's Lord Dedlock in the first four episodes?
He turns up briefly. He's kind of jovial and round-faced and...
Oh, Sir Leicester?
Yes.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah, he's Lord Dedlock.
I have things to say about him.
Sorry, I'm pausing while I'm trying to remember what the heck the show's called.
Use your words.
There's a TV show...
Use more words.
There's a TV show, political, British, which... Eventually, they did another version in America with the same name, starring the guy who used to be on the involved with the theatre near where I used to work until it was revealed that he was a terrible human being and was fired into the sun.
Kevin Spacey?
Yes. He was in an American TV show.
House of Cards.
House of Cards. I've got a very...
This is why you use your words. Carry on.
Yeah, it's really weird with Lord Dedlock because I have a very particular view of what he looks and acts like from having read Bleak House, which is the guy who is the principal character in the British
House of Cards.
Thank you, which is very...
sorry. We went through that whole thing and then you forgot what it was called again.
Yes.
Okay.
Very
austere... Welcome to my life, listeners.
Uh-huh. Very austere... and very repressed.
Right.
And then Sylvester that's turned up in this is all round-faced and jovial and...
Avuncular,
yes. Which is...
Apart from the incredible, horrifying, repulsive leching.
I don't recall, but I'll take your word for it.
Oof.
But we will no doubt come to that. This is the most editing ever.
No, I'm just going to let it run.
Okay, disaster.
Where do you want to start? Or have you got more facts?
I've got Tuppence Middleton plays Amelia Havisham, which is very nice.
I recognised her, now I can't remember where it was from.
No, I haven't written it down. It has been nominated for some film and drama awards. Best actor in a leading role, Stephen Rea, who plays Inspector Bucket. He's very good. And best actor in a supporting role, again for drama stuff, is Ned Dennehy, who plays Scrooge.
Okay. I wouldn't have said that there were main or supporting roles in this. It's very much ensemble.
Yes. Where do I want to start? How would you compare this to the other kind of period show, but different and silly, the one, the time-travelling Pride and Prejudice?
Oh, Lost in Austin.
Lost in Austin.
Oh, this is better. This is much better.
Better in what way?
I mean, it's better written, and it's better acted, and it's more interesting. I didn't like Lost in Austin, I have to say. And this is less silly.
I like Lost in Austin much against my better judgment.
Yeah, okay.
We've had some discussion recently about the difference between an enjoyable book and an enjoyable reading experience.
No, it was... I've been giving a lot more books 5 stars this year than in my previous 10 to 15 years of reading. And the difference is between it being a 5-star book versus a 5-star reading experience. So I am doing vibes-focused rating now, which I think is the right way to go, because you don't... people don't say this was a five-star book, they say this was a five-star read, because it's all very subjective. And you can have a five-star reading experience with a book which is objectively not that good. And you can also appreciate a really fantastic book, but it not be a five-star read because it's not that enjoyable.
See, I think this is, at least a four-star show, but it's not a four-star watching experience.
Okay.
Whereas I think that Lost in Austin is like a two and a half star show, but it's a four-star watching experience.
Oh, all right. I'm intrigued as to what rating you actually gave it. I'm going to have to look that up.
I can't remember. Because the difference is that partially because I know Pride and Prejudice a lot better, and partially because there's a lot fewer characters and you're given some anchors to kind of, lead you into the show, that it's just much more accessible.
This isn't massively accessible, I agree. There's so many characters.
This feels like it's been deliberately written for people who are already complete. I'm just saying the same thing over and over again.
You gave Lost in Austin 3.5.
It feels like it's a show where people are expected to be completely immersed in all this before it starts.
I don't know that much, and I just let it happen.
I've got a note here saying that there are 36 named characters in Wikipedia.
Yeah, I mean, it is a lot. It is a lot. I grant you, it is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I just let it happen, and they are largely distinguishable from one another.
I suspect that if we looked at other shows that I've liked in the past, that it has frequently been the case where there have been lots of parallel story threads going on that don't appear to be connected for a long time and then come together later on. But somehow in this show,
I don't think they are going to. I think they are just separate plot strands.
I don't know, but
I can't remember who killed Varley.
But in this, it's just, it feels that much more disconnected. Okay. I think one of the things that was difficult is just to know who's important. If you're being introduced to 20 characters in the first episode, your brain can't possibly cope with all of that, so you need to pick out the people who are really important to remember, and it's quite difficult to know who that is.
Fair. I didn't remember it being quite so overwhelmingly dense, and obviously that's more of a problem for you than for me, so sorry about that.
What else would you like to touch on?
I mean, I have very little to say. I enjoyed watching it. I'm keen to watch the rest, but as I said, it was a lot more doom-laden than I remembered.
We do say we like a short show. It might be a very short show.
Well, we're already at 25 minutes, so it's not going to be that short.
Yeah, but a lot of that really should be cut out. But anyway, spoilers, found myself wondering about whether the author is doing that thing which I said at the time when we did Lost in Austin, about whether the person who's written it has done so in order to fix things that they thought the original author had got wrong, and how dare they in some way. And there's a bit at the start of Dickensian where Little Nell from The Old Curiosity Shop, which I've not read, is busy dying. I saw a thing commenting on The Old Curiosity Shop a week or two before I saw Dickensian, where somebody on some social media thing or something somewhere had said, who would read a book about a little girl and her grandfather travelling from one place to another, where the grandfather spends all of their money on gambling, and then when they get to where they're going, she dies. It just seems absolutely appalling. And at the start of Dickensian, Nell is really
ill. My brain is going, Grave of the Fireflies.
Oh, shut up.
Yep.
At the start of Dickensian, Nell is really ill and then she recovers. And there's a question as to whether that's because the author of Dickensian has decided to rewrite what Dickens does, or whether Nell's going to drop dead by the end of the
show. I can't remember. Show.
Because the reason why I bring it up is that your brother, hello David, has mentioned that he's never watched the last episode of Dickensian because he doesn't want to see the dreadful reveal to Miss Havisham. And I wonder if the author's going to change the ending.
Again, I can't remember. I think I think it would be tricky with that. Well, yeah, because you're kind of like setting up people's expectations and then maybe subverting them. Because people who are fans of Dickens are going to know what happens to Miss Havisham and what state she's in at the beginning of Great Expectations. And yes, I was watching the first few episodes, and she's a fantastic character in this, and she's really well played, and I like her a lot, and I don't want to see that happen to her, so I agree. But then, yeah, it's difficult to know. You're kind of like on a knife edge then, not knowing, because you know it's all going to be, it has been manipulated, and that things are very different because it's all been mashed up together, and it's very much an alternate universe fan fiction, which is a very popular category of fan fiction. And then, you know, you can do what you want. So yes, I suppose that's where the intrigue comes into it and the tension, because you don't know how much it's going to be faithful and how much it's not.
AU, alternate universe fan fiction, always confuses the heck out of me, not that I've read very much, because there's sometimes it's the same characters but just in radically different situations. So you've got essentially the same characters with the same names and the same personality types, but in the modern day doing something.
Running a coffee shop is very popular.
Or you've got just characters that happen to have the same names but are completely different, which I've also seen, which just...
Such as 50 Shades of Grey.
Mm.
But I prefer the former. I have only ever done it myself with crossovers, so mixing two different TV shows together. Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I was going to
say... I think that's really fun.
The other thing I was going to say about fan fiction is that Jill Berup, who's a person who does videos on YouTube, did a very interesting one the other day about what's happening with the most popular fan fictions in AO3 Archive of Our Own, which is one of the most popular fan fiction sites, where publishers have started to realise how incredibly popular some of these things are and have been approaching the people who've written them and said, you've written this Harry Potter fan fiction which has had like 5 million people read it, could I pay you a phenomenal amount of money to rewrite this, to file just enough off it to change the character names and change, you know, the names of the places they go to and stuff, to turn it into a thing which isn't, you know, something that people can strike for copyright and then publish it as a book and make lots of money.
Alchemized.
And there's, I can't remember what it was she said, but there's one of the ones that's like top five AO3, and the author has been approached with something, you know, several hundred thousand pound advance to turn it into a not Harry Potter thing.
And alchemized.
Then, no, this isn't the one that's already out. This is another one. It's another one. But the industry seems to have suddenly realised that if you have an existing really popular base, people will buy your thing.
I mean, the last couple of years, there's been quite a few that are Raylo with the names and setting filed off. So Ali Hazelwood, who's a very, very popular, very, very successful contemporary romance writer, the majority of her like first four or five books are Raylo fanfiction.
Which I don't
in another guise.
Because I hate, well, not hate is the very strong word, I really did not like those films, and I really did not like either those characters, especially Kylo Ren, because there's no character there at all.
But anyway,
he basically has
dialogue. They're set in the modern day, largely in science related research or university settings.
That's
right. So there is nothing to say what makes them Rey and Kylo Ren, other than the fact that she's very small and he's very tall. But anyway, we're massively off track.
We're also off track. Miss Havisham is left a load of money by her father and 90% of his business. And his father basically in the will says to his son through the lawyer that I don't trust that you wouldn't blow all this money on, you know, gambling or whatever. You can have 10% stake in the
He wants to give the son impetus to survive on his own two feet and be rewarded by hard work.
That's very Victorian.
Mm-hmm.
This causes the son to go off and throw massive tantrum and essentially, by borrowing lots of money from Scrooge, hire
Meriwether Compeyson
thank you,
to
essentially seduce his sister, and then what happens before the start of Great Expectations is that Compeyson jilts her at the altar, and that's why she spends the rest of her life wearing a wedding dress.
Yes, but
my point was going to be that Miss Havisham is spending all of her time basically trying to get back into her brother's good graces and saying, we could be, you know, such good friends as we used to be, and I don't fit to see why it has to be like this, and I've got, not got a problem. She could just go to the lawyer and give him half of the thing.
Well, that's one of the suggestions, is that she do that, and she says that she can't because it would be going against their father's wishes, so she can't contest the will. That's what she says.
But there's a difference between contesting the will and accepting the will and then post hoc.
Yes, but she's saying that that would still be going against their father's wishes, and she must honour his wishes. I agree, it makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also stabbed through the heart because Compeyson rescues Amelia from her brother essentially attacking her in the street. And he's a very attractive young man. And I'd completely forgotten that he was evil. And then once I had remembered, or it had been revealed that he was working for Arthur, I'd forgotten just quite how incredibly horrible he is.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a suggestion towards the end of the episode that we watched that Arthur's kind of having second thoughts about it and might be willing to kind of offer an olive branch and become friends. And Compeyson is just like, nah, I am not going to let that happen. And he's just forging onwards without Arthur's consent anymore, and it's just horrifying, and I don't like it. But it's very effective because it definitely engaged my emotions. I did a lot of shouting at the television screen. Oh, and Fagin pimping Nancy out to Jacob Marley was just so repulsive.
I don't think I've read Oliver Twist.
I have.
I don't remember. I remember Fagin running a gang of child pickpockets.
Small child children, yes.
But I don't remember him so obviously having a prostitution.
No, I don't remember that either. I think that might be an invention for this, but I can't remember. But that was horrifying. And also, the Barbaries, who are the family from Bleak House, are facing financial ruin, as it happens a lot in Dickens.
And Victorian things in general. Because the financial ruin thing really reminded me of the book that I read.
David Copperfield.
No, the big, thick book that I was recommended at the reading retreat. Vanity Fair.
Vanity Fair,
really,
yes.
Really reminded me of Vanity Fair.
Yes, absolutely. And then Celesta turns up in the last episode that we watched, and he's all avuncular and sweet and lovely.
He
looks as though he's going to help them out, and then he lays eyes on Honoria, and oh my God, it gave me massively the ick when he was staring at her in the dress shop, and that obviously horrible things are going to happen later because he is apparently a lechy old man.
See,
and I thought he was going to be nice.
It's weird because in Bleak House, in my head, first of all, he's played by Ian Richardson, and second of all, he's about, I don't know, in his 70s or 80s.
Mm.
And Lady Dedlock is 40?
Yeah, so he's like
40
years older than her.
Yeah, but it's just...
It's horrifying.
But it's just weird seeing her being young kind of really threw me. But anyway.
Sure. But yes, quite a lot of it did give me the ick.
So I've got some stuff to talk about under diversity, as I'm sure you do too.
Yeah, a small amount.
But I only have one basic other thing to bring up about the main part of the show. Do you have anything else?
Let me check. No.
Okay, so my last thing is, who done it?
I don't know. I don't remember.
But can you work it out? Who do you have a main suspect? So the purpose of a show like this, when it's a murder thing, is to seed multiple clues to make you pick the wrong person.
Yeah.
So we've just finished watching a really good show called Bookish, written by and starring Mark Gatiss.
Meh.
I really liked it. And in the last episodes that we watched, there was very obviously clues leading you to suspect a certain character wasn't who they say they were, was actually the mysterious missing third sister. And it was a classic piece of misdirection.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a theory at the end of episode 4 of who done it, but I'm also 95% sure it's misdirection and won't actually be this person.
Probably. Well, Inspector Bucket immediately suspected Bill Sykes, but mm-hmm. it's since been determined that it was not his cosh what bashed in Jacob Marley's head, because there was a chip of wood embedded in his skull, which did not come from Bill Sykes' cosh.
Bill Sykes would be too easy. It's also like episode 4, and I'm going to get the back kind of episode 4.
Fagin's got Marley's wallet.
Has he?
Yes. Oh, so the wallet was missing, but the pocket watch was still there, which was pointed out as an oddness.
Mm-hmm.
But Fagin has Jacob Marley's wallet in his stash of valuables.
Oh, weird.
But it's possible he just came across the body, or one of the kids came across the body afterwards and looted that body.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he did question the guy in the old curiosity shop, but he'd already paid his debt.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So he doesn't really have much of a motive, because he wouldn't be able to get the money back from Scrooge.
Mm-hmm.
So otherwise, I don't know, really. What are you thinking?
I think, with the information we have now, which, as I say, at the end of episode 4 is almost certainly misdirection and totally wrong, I think it's Bob Cratchit.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because it's repeatedly shown that he's got no money, because he turns up for Christmas dinner with a, you know, a goose or whatever it is, and has nothing. And then when they're handing out the Christmas presents, the kids get, like, you know, a board egg.
Oh,
or whatever.
And he gives Mrs. Cratchit a really nice necklace.
He gives Mrs. Cratchit a really expensive necklace, and she says, "Where did you get the money to buy that?" And he says, "That's not for you to worry about."
True. I'd forgotten about that. So you think that he stole the money from Marley?
Yep. I think that he's been stealing money from Marley and Scrooge, and then has whacked Marley over the head.
Oh, wow. No, I wouldn't have gone there.
Yep.
Okay, well, that would be interesting.
I don't think it is him, though, because it's much too early.
Mm.
It's a really obvious...
Well, I hadn't
it's
seen
a really
that.
Obvious thing for the viewer to poke themselves on. And
Not if you're me.
I think it's misdirection, but,
okay.
But we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know.
Let's talk about some diversity stuff. We have a thing at the top of the diversity list which we don't normally talk about very much, which is class.
Do we? Okay.
And
yes, there's quite a lot about that.
There's quite a lot, as you would say, about that. There are some not very subtle snap cuts between kids in rags playing in the street and then the Havisham ball with everybody dressed up and the tables groaning with food.
Yeah.
So when I'm saying that the writer and the director are not being subtle, Dickens was not subtle either.
Oh, no, definitely not.
So they are following that vein, certainly. Have you got anything specific to say about that kind of thing?
What, diversity in general?
Well, no, class and money.
Not really.
Okay, do you want to pick another one then?
There's a Middle Eastern character, Mr. Venus, who is a taxidermist from Our Mutual Friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if his ethnicity is specified in the book.
He turns up because he's the closest thing that Inspector Bucket can find to a...
Coroner,
or
yes.
a forensic examiner.
Yes.
The interesting thing in this is that I don't know when this is set. I always think that Dickens is like 1870s, 1880s, but
no, it's much earlier.
But it is, in fact, much earlier. Because it's interesting to compare to another TV show we've been watching for a while, Miss Scarlet. And Miss Scarlet, again, is set in 1870s, maybe something like that. And one of the principal characters in Miss Scarlet is a forensic pathologist, essentially, is a coroner. And so by that point, that was a common role. But in Dickensian, that doesn't seem to be a role that exists at all.
No. Well, Bleak House is set in the late 1820s, so...
And, oh, so turn of the century.
So it must be, around 1800. And Great Expectations is set, again, early to mid-19th century, so this must be around about...
Has anybody mentioned...
1800.
So no one's mentioned Napoleon or Waterloo?
No. I think it's kind of a bit nebulous because I think that the setting is more as it would be in most Dickens novels rather than 20 to 30 years before. But it would be 20 to 30 years before because the characters are much younger.
It's interesting. Well,
I mean, Scrooge and Fagin and Sykes and Nancy and stuff are the right age for their book.
We could end up on a
so it's a bit
on a whole other tangent because I don't know how period-wise Dickens compares to Austen. Because I always felt
Slightly later.
Because I always felt that Dickens was 30 or 40 years after Austen.
10 or 15.
Is it as little as that?
Yeah, about 15 years later.
Oh wow! I always thought it was like a much bigger gap.
No.
Because Austen feels. Even though they go to the cities and they go and do stuff, it kind of feels pastoral in a lot of ways because there's a lot of stuff in the country in Austen. And even when people are going into the city...
There's still people who live in the country during the time of when Dickens was writing. It's just that's not where he sets his books.
I'm going to say, it's not about... But the rich people don't go out to their country houses. The rich people have their houses in town. But the my feeling, it's purely a vibe thing, but my feeling in Austen is that, you know, the streets are fairly empty and it's all relatively genteel. And by the time it gets to Dickens, it's Industrial Revolution and slums and, you know,
And that's when this is set in terms of
Austen, you don't...
the clothing and what the places look like.
Austen...
So it is set sort of early Victorian rather than pre-Georgian, if it was actually in the right time period for the characters.
But, I mean, we're off on another tangent here, but Austen, you don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't tend to get trains in Austen. Everyone goes everywhere by coach.
Yeah.
Whereas in Dickens is very much, you know, trains everywhere. But anyway, yes, we were talking... We were talking about class and
Mr.
money.
Mr. Venus.
Mr. Venus, yes.
Is played by an Iranian actor.
Yeah. The only non-white character, apart from him, that I can think of is Nell.
Yes, so she is biracial.
Which is...
interesting.
Interesting, yes. It's interesting that...
There's also Captain Horden's colleague who comes to give the message that Francis then burns in the fire.
Oh,
he's
yes.
He's also not white, but he's not named.
It's interesting...
And he's barely in it.
Yeah, but it is interesting that in a show where you are not doing... colorblind casting, and I have a whole, not necessarily for now, but interesting thing about how colorblind casting seemed to be really popular like 3 or 4 or 5 years ago and seems to have gone out of popularity again now, which is just interesting. But in a show where colorblind casting is not a thing, to have Nell not being white is just an interesting choice.
Yes.
But anyway, so yeah, that's there for race, but let's talk about gender.
So, I mean, women don't get a great representation in Dickens regardless, so it's
get a great representation in Dickens because women didn't get great representation in Victorian England.
Yes, very true. But in this, they are
unless
mistreated, infantilised, disempowered, deceived, presented as drunks or harridans or nagging wives in the bit parts.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not great. But then it's Dickens, so... what are you going to do, really?
I mean, I'm literally trying to think of successful, strong female characters in Dickens.
Yeah.
Like, at all, and I'm...
Well, Lady Dedlock.
I mean, the problem with Lady Dedlock is she spends the whole book being terrified that her dreadful secret will come out. And, you know, so that's her issue all the way through.
Yeah,
but,
so it's not great.
I mean, the actual protagonist of Bleak House... is her daughter, whose name is Estelle, I think, and she's great, and she's a very self-confident, empowered character. She's really good, but she's not in this because she's not born yet.
No, fair. There's a range of female characters, and there are a lot of female characters, but yes, they don't get a good shout because of the setting of the stories.
I mean, it's difficult to in this. You can pick out a lot of bad guys in Dickensian. It's relatively difficult to pick out any good guys. There's bad guys and there's...
Weak people.
And that's basically the two
apart
sorts of...
Apart
from possibly Amelia Havisham, but...
Although, as you say, if she could get over herself in terms of keeping to the...
Yeah.
terms of the will, she could have saved herself a lot of trouble.
Yeah. I mean, the only good guy you can possibly pull out of this is Bob Cratchit, and I think he done it. So it's difficult to tell.
Guess we'll find out.
Other than that, I am done.
Okay. So that about wraps it up for this month's discussion. It's time for the ratings. We use a standard 5-star rating system with half stars allowed. Dave, what is your rating for the first 4 episodes of Dickensian?
I'm going to give it 2.5.
Oh, harsh.
Two because of the just general bafflement, but then another half star because it got better.
And you do still want to watch the rest?
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that by the time I've watched most of the rest of them, it'll be up to, like, at least 3.5, because the acting is great, the directing is really good, the costumes and the settings are great, the cinematography is really good.
Just a bit of a steep learning
curve. It's just, at the end of episode 2, I was like, who are all these people and what the hell is going on? What is the plot? I'm so lost.
Okay.
And if I hadn't been watching it for the podcast, I definitely would not have got past episode 2.
Okay.
Because I had no idea what was going on. What about you?
I'm going to give it 3.5. I remembered enjoying it a lot more because I remembered it being funny. But I think maybe I was just delighted by the fact that this sort of mashup fan fiction thing had been created and was being popular on TV. So I was pleased by that, and I appreciated the cleverness of how it's all woven together.
Yes.
But I remembered it being a lot more fun than it is, because it's quite dreary. So 3.5 for me.
It's an interesting comparison for me to the televised version of Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
Because although Vanity Fair has a lot fewer characters, I mean, it's got, what, like 6 or 7 principal characters, if that.
Mm-hmm.
I again wonder how much I would have enjoyed the TV adaptation if I hadn't read the book relatively recently beforehand and really knew all the characters in depth.
It does help, yeah. Agreed.
So, yeah. I suspect partly that I will be enjoying this a lot more by the time we've got halfway through, because I'll actually understand what's going on a lot more. But I also suspect I would have enjoyed it significantly better if I had, for example, just read Great Expectations beforehand. Sure. I think would have made a huge difference.
So
did you still love it?
I'm hoping that I'm going to love it overall as we progress through, and I did enjoy it and I do want to watch the rest, but I didn't enjoy it as much as I remembered.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we doing next month?
So next month I am choosing a very random 2003 television show with Mandy Patinkin in it.
Oh, awesome.
Called Dead Like Me.
Yes, I have never seen that, and I have sometimes wanted to.
Okay.
But I never have, so I must have gone off the idea. Anyway, yes, I'm happy with that.
It's very weird. I remember really liking it at the time.
Excellent.
Okay, so that is the end of this month's episode of Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? Many thanks to Cambo for our theme music, and thank you everybody for listening. If you like this show, please rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you have any comments, or if you want to tell us about a time you shared some media you love and whether or not you still loved it afterwards, you can email us at willyoustilloveit@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
So please join us next month to see what Annie thinks of Dead Like Me.
And whether or not Dave still loves it after our discussion.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye. Thank you.